in our final presentation, Open Access Week. I first wanted to explain where our normal CIDR host, Lynn Anderson, is not going to be with us today, but I'm sure you all appreciate find out the job she has done all this week and keeping us on track and organized and moderated. And to remind you that she hosts CIDR sessions the second Wednesday of every month, and the fall schedule is posted on the CIDR site. I also wanted to say a special thanks to Tony Tin, who is with family concerns in Hong Kong, and so he isn't able to present this morning, as was on the original poster. But I also wanted to acknowledge that Tony did most of the work of organizing and promotion of Open Access Week, so we're really grateful for his contribution. This morning we're having a slightly different format. This build is a panel presentation or a panel discussion. It might be more like three mini presentations. We all, of course, have got too many slides, so we will be going quickly through them. But we hope that we'll be roughly dividing the time equally amongst the three of us. If the person stops before their 20 minutes, then we'll have some immediate questions. But if they don't, we'll squeeze them in at the end. So I guess without further ado, just to make a note to you that the recordings of all of the CIDR sessions, the Open Access Weeks, are on the Open Access site, and thanks to Colin for doing that. We'll just steal one of Lynn's slides and find out where we're all coming from this morning. So if you come over on the left and you grab that little, or click on the little star, and then you can tell us where you're dialing in from. Okay, so it seems like we have a mostly North American crew this morning, we will, lots of dots and a Western gang. I see somebody from Ontario as well. So welcome, everybody. I think what I'd like to do is first is introduce our three speakers to you. First is Dr. Cindy Ives. And Cindy has worked in higher education for many years in a variety of locations, contexts. She's been an instructor, a faculty developer, a researcher, a distance educator, an administrator, and an evaluation consultant. Currently, Cindy is the director of the Center for Learning Design and Development at Athabasca University. And she came to us from McGill University, and previous to that, she did her doctoral work at Concordia University. And Cindy's going to be talking using my microphone. She's sitting beside me now, having a little bit of mic problems on her machine. So it will look like it's me, but I'm sure you'll notice that it is not. Our second speaker is Colin Elliott. Colin Elliott is the digitization coordinator for Athabasca University. He works out of our library system, and he coordinates the digitization efforts of the AU library, as well as various mobile learning projects, AU's digitization portal, our educational repository, AU Space, and various mobile projects. And Colin has presented in a number of e-learning and mobile library learning conferences, and it's a real treat to have him with us this morning. And for myself, I'm the Canada Research Chair in Distance Education at Athabasca University, and a member of TECRI, the Technology Enhanced Knowledge Research Institute at Athabasca, Director of CIDR, and currently the editor of the International Review of Research in Open and Distance Learning. So, without further ado, let me turn it over to Cindy Ives. Go ahead, Cindy.
Thanks, Terry. I'm not going to take my 20 minutes, so if there are questions, maybe we'll do that, but you decide as you're the moderator. I want to talk to you a little bit about three types of initiatives within the Center for Learning Design and Development at Athabasca University. We have been involved in open sharing, producing and sharing open educational resources, using open educational resources that others have created, and then in a project for that has been searching and bringing together open materials for adaptation and program development. So we're responsible in the Center for Learning Design and Development for facilitating course development, design development, and production activities for all levels of courses at Athabasca University. We have a unit that is multidisciplinary with professionals in the areas of visual learning, multimedia design and development, editing, and production. So to talk about the first initiative, it was a Inukshuk-funded grant. The Inukshuk Foundation provided money for us to develop math support for calculus. These are just-in-time tutorials. Five of them were produced in the period 2007 to 2009. They are designed to help students remember or learn for the first time basic math concepts, algebra, functions, and so on, things that are necessary for calculus. And one of the reasons research shows that students fail so in such great numbers in introductory calculus is because they haven't mastered these basic math concepts. So we began our work with the Carnegie Mellon Cognitive Tutor Authoring Tool, which was funded by the Hewlett Foundation, but it didn't have the capacity that we wanted for feedback, advanced feedback, and so on. So we developed out of that our own tutor authoring tool. It provides interactive practice and assessment, that is self-testing activities for students. The tutorials that we created are linked off our introductory introductory calculus site, but the modules themselves and the code have both been deposited with learning object repositories that are listed here, WikiEducator, Curriculum Merlot, and they're also available off the Athabasca University Open Courseware site. I lost my slide. All right. The second project that we have been involved in recent years is the development of a physics course in vibrations and waves. The content for vibrations and waves hasn't changed much in recent years, and the professor who wanted to develop this course found the MIT Open Courseware and determined that the lectures, the video lectures that were available for this course were ideally suited for our course. He spent, however, a great deal of time summarizing them and contextualizing them for Athabasca University's open and distance environment. This course will be open on the 1st of November, and we haven't had a chance to test it yet, but the course will be available in Moodle, and we'll have other online resources, and it has a very small textbook. Once the course is open, we will also upload it to the Athabasca University Open Courseware site, and people will be able to have a look at it. And professor took it to MIT and showed them what he'd done with their materials, and they were quite delighted because, as you will know probably, the MIT material is not accredited material, and so what we are now doing is providing accreditation on these materials. And the third project that we've been involved in recently was Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade of the Canadian government funded an initiative with Athabasca University Center for Distance Education, my center, and TECRI, the Technology Enhanced Knowledge Research Institute at Athabasca, and the University of the West Indies, to do some collaborative program development using open educational resources. The specific program was a graduate diploma in instructional design to be offered by UWE, and a group of us from Athabasca University went to Barbados last spring to work with their instructional designers and program administrators to identify open educational resources that would be available and appropriate for graduate courses in instructional design. Obviously, this is an area where there's a lot of material available, and we were able to pull together 7 detailed outlines out of the 12 possible graduate courses. These 3 projects have really led us to understand what the practical barriers might be to using open educational resources in course development. Not all subjects have content available, or it may be available in the topic that we're interested in, but not at the level that we're interested in. Content is difficult to locate. Not all content has been made available through learning object repositories or other places, so you can search and search and still not find. Authorship and copyright information is not necessarily well identified, and as a result, the materials that you want to use that appear to be open may in fact not be open at all levels because there may be embedded copyrighted materials in them, and unpacking that is time-consuming and takes real special expertise as well. The quality of the materials that are found may not be up to your particular institution's standards. It may not be accurate. The media production values might not be sufficient. On the other hand, that doesn't mean that you can't invest the resources to bring these materials up to the standard that are necessary. Cultural context was one of the issues that we discovered clearly in the work with the University of the West Indies, but also the work that we had to do to contextualize the MIT OpenCourseWare for Athabasca University students. So localization is time-consuming again and requires special skills. There are clearly technical barriers, file formats, software versions, compatibility issues, and not all educational institutions have the technical skills on-site to address those kinds of things. And of course, if you're linking to files on the internet, you may lose them if you're just linking them. And so the issues around importing open educational resources into your own educational materials need to be clarified. And so that's really our experience over the last couple of years with open materials. And I don't know, Terry, if there are questions and you want me to answer them now.
I do, Cindy. I appreciate, you know, the sort of practical on the ground. We've seen the barriers to using as you see on the screen. Let me ask the first question while everyone else is preparing. But what about the benefits? Could you be just overview of them in particular? I guess I'm thinking of, does it really save money?
Well, you know, on 3 tiny projects, I'm not sure that I can say whether it saves money or not. I think that if we were designed and to develop our course materials for Athabasca using open educational resources, we would save money in the long run because our system would be set up to do that. We would certainly save money for students, I would think, in terms of the cost of publications and the textbooks, for example, that they might need to use. And if we were properly skilled and staffed to do this kind of work, I think we would actually get quite good at it, and it would save money in the long run. It'll take some investment dollars in the short term, I think.
Right. Thank you, Cindy. Let me release the mic, and I hope somebody will be brave and ask a question or text one in. I see Peggy did, and I hope Cindy covered your question with her last answer. So somebody please grab the mic and address the question. Yeah.
The top 3 barriers. Well, Peggy, let me address another advantage first before I do the top 3 barriers. I think one of the advantages for a place like Athabasca University, which establishes itself as an open university, one of the advantages is that using open materials actually adds to the open publishing and the open scholarly work and the work that the library is doing and helps us be more consistent in our own impressions on the world. In terms of the top 3 barriers, there's probably a barrier I didn't name, which is also a practical barrier, which might be the top one, and that is resistance on the part of content experts. A lot of that resistance, I think, comes from a lack of awareness, a lack of understanding, and that's why we've been involved in these three pilot projects, is to be able to showcase what's possible. The other top barrier, I think, might have to do with technical issues, depending on the level of skills in your staff, the technical barriers, the file content, and so on is probably another top barrier. And the third one, I would guess, would be quality. I know in the open discussion that's going on about OER right now, at the international conversation, quality is a major issue, and localization, different local definitions of what quality is are of concern as well. Interesting question, Randy. At the moment, we're not producing a lot of open materials, but we are searching for a lot of materials. And I think we have some good ideas about what quality is in terms of currency, about the originator of the materials and so on, but we don't have a policy at this stage. We're really working on a case-by-case basis. Criteria for how we search. We actually did a presentation at the CNIE conference on the process of that search, so we might be able to extract something from that. Cheryl, I agree. Another advantage is bringing in expertise, absolutely. I will try to post the slideshare link as soon as I can find it, you bet. Resistance or policy restricting all Athabasca course materials to be made open access. We have no policy on that at this stage. The reason why we don't have is because probably we just haven't gotten around to it yet. I think we need to address this in the not very distant future.
Okay, well, thank you, Cindy. A special thanks for keeping within your 20 minutes. I'm sure that once we get through Collins and my presentation, Cindy will be here if any more generalized or questions come out or specific ones about our work at Athabasca. So thank you very much for that. Next, I'd like to turn it over to Colin Elliott to talk about some of the projects that he's involved with here at Athabasca University.
Okay, thanks, Terry and Cindy. Today, I'm here to talk about two different projects I've been working on relating to open access. One of them is AU Space, and the other one is the bibliography of the Athabasca River Basin. As Terry mentioned, Tony's not here, so I'll be doing both of these today. So I wanted to start with a crisis that we're facing. It's a digital preservation crisis. We're producing so much information in so many different ways, and we're producing more and more information all the time. So we have this sort of crisis, is how can we preserve this for other people to find and build upon? And we've actually worked with faculty that have produced a lot of articles over time and bring us their bibliographies to start work on AU Space, which I'll explain more about in a minute. And they've actually lost some of their old work. They don't have it. The journal has been discontinued. There's not many copies left, and we have to do a real search for it. So there really is a big problem that we're facing. So to meet this challenge, you can build an institutional repository, and I'm just going to read this quote, but it's a set of services that a university offers to the members of its community for the management and dissemination of digital materials created by the institution and its community members. In our case, we've built AU Space. So it's our institutional repository, and it's based on a software called DSpace, which was developed, already recognize these names from Cindy's presentation as well, but developed by MIT and Hewlett-Packard. And it's used widely across the world at, I think, over 700 institutions now. And it was implemented at AU to address two main problems. The first is the crisis that I mentioned, and the second one is to actualize AU's open access research policy. So we are the first university in Canada to have this policy, and it encourages faculty to publish in an open access journal and self-archive their work in AU space to ensure that it's freely available and accessible to everyone. And I just want to talk about then why, you know, we've talked about it this week. We've heard a lot of good examples on why open access, but I just want to reiterate some of them. There's unrestricted access to ideas and discovery, wider distribution for authors, for the creators. Why they'd want to do this is more citations. Terry Anderson, you know, his book, it was talked about by Fritz on Tuesday, I think, is a great example of wider distribution, and I'm sure more citations because it's open access. There's long-term access to resources, so they're not there until the journal or the publisher disappears. They're there perpetually. Researchers have more control over their own work. When you submit to a journal that's not open access, you basically sign all control over, at least most of the time. So researchers then maintain control of their own work. There's lower costs, lower costs of production. And I work in the library, and one of our, well, probably our biggest cost is paying for all these journal subscriptions. And in some cases, we're paying for work that has been produced by somebody here at AU. So if we have it in an open access format, it means we don't have to pay for it. And I think Rory probably mentioned paying for it two and three times in some cases. And lastly, the other reason why open access is some granting agencies are now requiring it. So if you get a grant from somebody, they require that anything you publish is available open access. So AU Space, what it does is it stores documents safely and permanently using a lot of different technologies to ensure that they are preserved and accessible. It also adds search capabilities so they're easily searched. The whole document can be indexed, and then if it's searched through Google or whatever, it can be retrieved. So sort of back to AU Space, I guess a bit more about the attributes of AU Space. It's a web-based database, institutionally defined, so it's organized like the institution, cumulative and perpetual. It's part of the process of scholarly communication. We collect, store, disseminate to all of the research. And open access, which we've already mentioned, and interoperable. And I just want to mention it's OAI compliant here, which is Open Archives Initiative. This means that all the data that AU Space takes in about an item is stored in a standard format that can be shared with other OAI compliant repositories or harvesters that search OAI compliant repositories. So it makes a standard way to easily find things that are open access. This is sort of a diagram of how AU Space works. A submitter sort of puts in a jumble of things, but basically what is required is a file, which, you know, let's say is an article, and metadata about the file. So the metadata describes the file. You'd have the title field, the author field, and all that sort of thing, some subjects, hopefully an abstract, anything like that. And that all makes up one item within AU Space. The item is part of a larger collection, so if it was a faculty member, it'd be perhaps his or her collection, and that faculty member is also part of a greater community. It may be the faculty or center they belong to, or a different type of research project. And this is all organized by AU Space so that the end user easily searches and finds the information that they need. So for the content we have on AU Space, you can see it's a really wide variety of things. Articles, theses, audio files, video files, different library collections, data sets, different types of research documents. Now we're working on making it our default repository for ETC. So any students creating a final project or a thesis, we'll be submitting it to AU Space. So the current status of AU Space, well, before I go on, actually, I should mention how we can self-archive. First of all, the easiest way to make it happen is to publish in open access journals. This ensures that you have the rights to your work, and you can go ahead and put it in AU Space. The second thing that we usually do is use a website called Sherpa Romeo, and it provides a list of publishers and their policies on self-archiving. So it's a great place to start looking and find out if the faculty member can self-archive, and if they can, what restrictions apply. It could be only the preprint, you have to link to the publisher's version. There's all sorts of different restrictions that can be put on it. The third thing that we suggest for anybody creating something that they can't make open access, or aren't willing to make open access, I guess I should say, is or to submit to an open access journal, is to use something called the Stork Copyright Addendum. And this allows the author to retain key rights and self-archive their work. So as you submit it to a journal that is closed access, you'd include this, and hopefully they'd allow you to do that. The fourth option, and this happens a lot when we go back and help a faculty member with all of their work, is we have to request permission. This takes time, but we've actually had quite a bit of success with it. And have had a lot of publishers grant us permission to put the author's work in the institutional repository. So AU Space, it's been here for 5 years. We have a lot of interest from different parts of the university. We have over 1,700 items in AU Space now, and we have faculty and researchers using it for self-archiving and supporting open access and the open access policy. So just to sort of summarize, I guess, the actualization of AU Open Access using AU Space, it just allows, gives all of the faculty members sort of a way to do it, to make sure that their work is freely available, to make sure that people can build upon their work. And as an example, this week's talks and last week's are all stored in AU Space, and they'll be searchable by Google and accessible to everyone. I have some references here that I'm not going to go through, but will be available, again, as I said, in AU Space when this is complete. The next thing I want to talk about is the bibliography of the Athabasca River Basin. This is not, I think when most people imagine a bibliography, they imagine paper with a long list of things, and this is quite a bit different. It's going to be a digital tool for knowledge and open access. So we're putting all of these resources, at the very least, the references to them online. First, though, I just want to talk about the project a little bit. This is a map of the basin right here. You can see the blue part is in Alberta. The sort of top right has some green part in Saskatchewan. And the basin stretches from Jasper National Park to Lake Athabasca. It's a really interesting area, especially it's in the news a lot right now. Even today, I think there's a ruling coming down on some problems they had in the tar sands. But it does include the oil sands, so there's lots of interesting things happening with that. In addition to the tar sands, though, there's a lot of history in the basin. There's a lot of different types of land use. There's forestry, other types of mining, a lot of agriculture. So lots of things happening within the basin. At AU, we have the Athabasca River Basin Research Institute, which is in overall charge of this project. The project has two main aims, to develop a bibliographic database that will include sort of these broad areas of sciences, humanities, social sciences, and economics. The sciences group has been working on it for a few years now and have over 25,000 references already in the database. The first phase is to create this bibliography, and the second phase is to digitize whatever we can from that bibliography so that we can ensure that everything that we do find, as much as possible, is available for people to look at and start their research with. For benefits, The first one is access. We want, this is again under the Athabasca River Basin Research Institute. So we want people to be able to access this research and find all of these things, and then hopefully use this as a resource to build further research. For sharing, we want this to be shared with as many people as possible, and to make sure that it's searchable, retrievable, and reusable for research and study. So how do we achieve all this? Well, a big part of the answer is open access. Open access means it's easily accessed, shared, and stored. The ideas and research are available to everyone. And we're doing this like AU Space, so it's going to be OAI compliant, so that it's easily and consistently searched and harvested. So again, harvesters will be able to go in there and search across and find this. Google will find everything in here very easily, and will really sort of harness all the strengths of having open access to make sure that it is everything here is disseminated as widely as possible. I also want to talk about the opportunity that open access provides us, because we have open access journals that are becoming more common. It means we can already link to more resources. If somebody, even a researcher at AU, has put the article in their institutional repository, we can again link to that very easily. And so that makes it a lot easier for us, because if something is at one of the four, you have to pay for it at one of those sites, it's very hard for us to link to it. We can't link to it. We can link to somewhere where they have an option to buy it, but we want to make it as available as possible. And it also makes it a lot easier for us to do copyright research. If we have less things to research, it removes the need to do copyright research on anything that is open access, which saves us a lot of time if we're hoping to digitize it. So I just want to conclude by saying that by utilizing open access, all the content and effort that we put into this project will be shared, used, and built upon by other researchers, and will continue to grow into a larger and larger project. So that's the end of these two little parts of the presentation today. And I see a question from Peggy Che here. Do you have to be an AU faculty to use this service? The answer is basically yes. We have a few people that are part of projects that are external to AU that can use it, but it's for AU faculty to use it for self-archiving. Hopefully your own institution has something or is considering building something that would serve this purpose. I'll turn over the mic if anybody else has some questions.
Well, thank you, Colin. It is interesting. It'd be interesting if you have an institutional repository at your own institution. I wonder if you can give us a little green check mark, and if you don't have one at your institution, if you can give us a red X mark. Well, I'm glad to see that the University of Manitoba does, and you from Athabasca, and a lot of people can't find the button, or maybe they don't know whether their institution has a repository or not. I guess I would recommend it. I know it's been useful for myself to have my materials up there, but I'm always accused of looking at the glass half empty instead of half full. But Rory and I were the prime pushers of this policy that encouraged faculty members to put their materials in the Open Archive, and for about halfway through its policy formation and development through various committees at Athabasca, it required that faculty members put their materials in an open access repository. And we couldn't get that passed to our academic council. It seemed to be some people thought this was a huge infringement on their academic freedoms. And I must say that we discussed this with other people around the world when we were drafting our policy. And that was the advice from the old hands was, unless you make it compulsory like they did at Harvard, it ain't going to happen. But now we have 5 years experience, and we do have 1,800 articles. But I wonder, Colin, if you can give us an extent of, you know, how many of the faculty members are actually putting their materials there, and what the barriers are to those, or to those you've talked to, or maybe you've only talked to those who have placed the materials there. But there must be some barriers because there is obviously more than 1,700 career contributions from 150 full-time academic staff. So could you comment on that, Colin?
Yeah, for sure. We find that it sort of comes in stages where, for example, a specific center, somebody gets interested in it, and then their center, a few other people do it. And so we get sort of clusters of people doing it that way. And, you know, then it's just depends on the faculty member whether or not they're interested in doing it. Some are maybe more interested in the possibilities of self-promotion and that sort of thing, and they're maybe more likely to use it. In terms of faculty members that don't use it, they give us, I think, an answer we hear a lot of anyways, I don't have time, which I really don't like is an argument, because they put all this time into, you know, if we're talking about an article, let's say, writing an article, I mean, it takes an awful lot of time, and then they can't take the 10 minutes. You know, let's say it would take an hour to set up and get used to it, and then 10 minutes from then on, not even, to submit each article. So that's what we hear the most often is, I don't have time. But, you know, it's an unfortunate argument. I think, you know, everybody would benefit a lot from this. As for the question, can anyone access AU Space? Yes. Terry, as you said, has put a lot, if not all, his articles up there, and anybody can go and access and read those. So it's not just restricted to AU staff or AU students, it's open to the public. There are some exceptions within AU Space, but in general, you can access anything. As for Carmen's question, I see up there, are there any plans to tie an AU course into this River Basin repository? At this point, no. I mean, we're still pretty, from our perspective anyway, it's still pretty early on. We're just starting to get a website up, and we'll be developing that over the next year. And then as for after that, I think we'll have to see how it shapes up and how it may integrate with some, not only courses, but other parts of research at the university.
Maybe I could try to answer Cheryl's question, but I'm also going to hope that Cheryl has a mic to talk about her experiences with an open access repository at the University of Manitoba. The question is, does it make a difference if you're publishing for tenure or promotion? The way I differentiate between putting it in AU Space, I think that that's a distribution vehicle. It's not necessarily a publishing vehicle. And by publication, I mean that an editor or a journal or a peer review process has gone on to make that materials or to attest to its accuracy and currency and things like that. So most articles or the stuff that I've put up in the AU Space are articles that have been peer reviewed and published elsewhere. We also, although allow preprints and things that maybe haven't been formally published to be distributed via AU Space, but AU Space is not a publisher, it's just a distributor. So if you go for tenure or promotion and they require peer-reviewed journals, articles, they would, hopefully they would be on the site of that reviewing journal, but they would also be on AU Space to increase the access. Cheryl, can you tell us about the use or adoption or anything that strike you as different about what happens at Manitoba than what Colin has just mentioned?
Hi, Terry. I don't really have a lot of experience with MySpace at U of M. What we've been using it mostly for a distance program is the learning object repository for our learning objects for our courses. But I don't have enough experience about the other components of it to really say anything intelligent about it.
Okay, well, there's another application. The basic idea is that if you have a repository like this, it can be used for any form of digital, whether it be audio, video, graphic, text, and you make it available to the world. And I think that's a really important function of universities. And I want to thank Colin and the library for the work of maintaining this system, and of course MIT for developing it and making it an open source product itself. Okay, now moving to the third part of this presentation, where I'm going to try to, you know, sort of a bit overview things that we've talked about all this week and the specific examples that we've heard this morning by talking about more generally about open scholarship. And this is part of a larger presentation that I did in the UK last year, and so there will be a link to the more complete set of slides at the end. And I am going to blast through these, so do feel free to text in a question or raise your hand or have a comment at the end about what type of an open scholar you are and why you are and why you are not. So one of the problems with managing change is to get everyone to sing together. And I think that we're seeing such huge technical advances, we're seeing pedagogical advances, and trying to merge them into an ethical response and system, I think it is a real challenge. And it takes, as the slide says here at the bottom, it takes leadership, and that's what I think people who are spending their time coming here to Open Access, you're probably a leader in your own institution, but you also have to expect some rough and tumble disruption, because I think that comes with the turf as well. What we have to do, and you heard this yesterday in George's presentation, where we have to get beyond the group learning, and we have to get beyond systems that are just designed to track, control, and lead to ones that that motivate students to really prepare them for lifelong learning, to try to say that what they're doing in formal education is not the end of their learning, it's just the very beginning, and so we have to equip them for a lifetime of learning in many different ways. And there are lots of promising signs. Of course, the Web 2.0, as well as even the Web 1.0, is just the opportunity to share the growth in awareness and insights and value. I mean, it seems like every year goes by, the case for open access publishing continues to grow, the resistance begins to shrink, and I think we're starting to see a lot more action now than we were a year ago. And we're having increasing effective pedagogical models that are spanning cultures and contexts and trying to, you know, get ways like Wayne talked to us on Monday for collaboration across continents in producing educational opportunities. And we're starting to see lots of real educational alternatives. Remember Rory said how sometimes allowing for commercial exploitation of open access resources may go against your a sense of justice, but it may actually produce content that's in the hands of people all around the world. And then, of course, there's good old death and retirement for some of our colleagues. So what is an open scholar? Well, one of the things is an open scholarship is transparent, and that means the ability to view, share thoughts, actions, resources, ideas, and interests. Making yourself digitally visible, establishing the digital presence, it makes it so that others can find, can link to, and benefit from what you're doing, and the kind of insights and ideas that you have. This is an article by Christian Dalsgaard, who was published last year in the Rodel, and it talks about this whole idea of transparency and the value of leaving digital traces. And that is as a student, so other students can see what you've done in your term and when you're struggling to learn with this, and as well as faculty and others, and the necessity and the growing capacity to manage those traces and turn them into educational learning opportunities. So what is an open scholar? This is from a scholar at Utah State University, Gideon Burton, And he says, open scholar is someone who makes their intellectual projects and processes visible and who invites and encourages ongoing criticism, and he allows other people to use that scholarship or that contribution to enhance it and to build upon it. And Gideon listed a number, three or four different ways of what open scholarship is all about, or what an open scholar is on his blog, and I've sort of expanded them here. And so first of all, open scholars create work that it involves social learning, media richness, it allows participation, many of the ideas that George talked about yesterday, ubiquity and persistence. Persistence, again, is very important, that the knowledge that and the process of gaining knowledge, as Stuart would say, is a process so that others can follow in those footsteps. Open data collection and research process, and of course, open scholars create connections with other people and help others to create new connections. And I hope that in some small way, this Open Access Week has allowed you to expand the kind of connections and the network that you have already. Open scholars use and contribute open educational resources to create an open culture. And we've heard talk about Merlot and OER Commons. And the biggest reason we asked Cindy for benefits, what is ironical is that so many of our faculty say the reason that they don't do this and they don't do that is because they have no time. And I argue that using these things, and Cindy's examples, I think have shown at least, and I know there was one other faculty member at Athabasca who took an MIT course and revised it, maybe the same one, but anyways, he just talked about it doesn't give you, you know, it doesn't take away all time, but it significantly cuts down the amount of time, and that is the currency of academia these days. Open resources, this is just an example. I was asked to do a workshop on open educational resources, and I was thinking, oh, now I got to spend a week getting the materials for a whole week long. And then, bang, I came across this overview with all the kinds of activities about copyright and how to find, compose, adapt, use, and share. And I can download this thing for free. And so, bang, there's an example of it saved me a week of time. And this text is still available now online. Or you can buy it for $19. Open Archive, Scholar Self Archive. I think Colin made the case for making your scholarship peer and publicly available and accessible. Open scholars apply their research. There is some really neat projects on the go, and I commend again the Hewlett Foundation for not only supplying funding for course digitization and creating open education, but now they funded a number of research projects in the UK and the US where they kind of say, well, who is using this content and what are the barriers to it, and how can we make it work more effectively? Open scholars do open research. And this is more in the natural sciences, but this idea of instead of gathering your data, keeping it under lock and key until you publish, and then maybe still keeping it under lock and key, to make the whole process of your data collection and make it all publicly visible so that other students and other researchers can see the creation of your project as it evolves. And there are things like Open Notebook and Open Wetware, are searchable repositories and ways that you can document in an open fashion the science work that you're doing. Open scholars filter and share with others. Of course, Stephen Downs' OL Daily is probably the most popular resource in Canada for the ed tech types. Anyways, every working day he sends out a list of links of what he's found and trolled, and as he says, it's an open list with attitude, and so you get all of the thoughts that Stephen has, and most of them are worth listening to. I've been lots of edu blogs, my own blog, and many ways that we can now. Of course, I should be adding Twitter here and other ways that we make our content visible. And what is most important, I think, is that we're all overwhelmed with information, so we need networks that filter and recommend stuff to our attention. We support open learning alternatives. This is the world's first University of the People, now offers three degree programs, tuition free. They rely on volunteer labor, on contributions from foundations and industry, and self-tutoring and peer-to-peer learning, and they also charge a small amount to write the exam. So I hope that it succeeds. It's early days, but you might want to check out the University of the People, and they started this fall, and it seems like they've gotten off to a good start as far as I've been able to find. Open Scholars publish in open access journals. This is a recent study that Olavzaki Richer and myself did. We actually published this in the Journal of Distance Education a couple of months ago, and we compared open access journals to commercially published ones, and trying to suggest that do you get more citations in distance education if you put them out in open access, and it doesn't have a bigger impact. And we weren't able to find a significant difference in the number of citations. And the reason, I think, is that the older journals have been around longer and they get more citations because they have more articles, and most of the older distance ed journals are closed, whereas most of the new ones are open. So maybe that accounts for the most significant difference. But we did show by that study that at least within the subset of a publication that is distance education scholarship, that it does not inhibit the impact and the number of citations if you publish in an open way. Open Scholars comment openly on the works of others by annotating resources. Brainify is Murray Goldberg's project, where he's trying to get people by discipline to bookmark and recommend and talk about the things that are important in their own lives. And of course, there's Site You Like and Deagle and Delicious and other automated or online animation systems. And we need to bookmark for our own purposes, but if we bookmark on our own machines, then that data cannot be aggregated and it can't be put to benefit other people. So that's why I strongly urge you to, I use Deagle, but there are many different systems for socially bookmarking content and thereby contributing to open scholarship. Open Scholars build networks. I'm sure even this one, Cider, or Scope from BC is a great network that provides professional development activities for each other. This is the ALT-C conference that I presented this originally. ALT-C is a wonderful conference in the UK, but hardly anybody but UK people even go to it, but it's one of the best ones in the world. Scholars lobby for copyright reform. I'm sure if you heard Rory's presentation on Wednesday, you'll see the efforts that he's going to make sure that the, especially relevant in Canada right now, as the latest bill is in at the House now being considered, and all the digital lock issues that accompany it. And here's the perfect copy protection from a manufacturer's or a publisher's point of view that it completely destroys after one play. I'm sure that's what they're after. Open Scholars assign open textbooks. There is a burgeoning publishing industry, the California Open Source Textbook Project. Flatworld is a commercial company, but all of the textbooks you can download for free. If you want them in audio format or you want them in hard copy, you pay for them. And they're trying to, drastically cut the cost of textbooks through a commercial operation that has enhancements that you may wish to pay for. Open Scholars induce open students, and they encourage students to become co-producers, to get in there and edit Wikipedia, to make their contributions, their class projects, to put them in repositories and make them available to others. Open School Scholars support open students. There's the openstudents.org project where and they have their Bill of Rights, and they're trying to actively lobby for the open access world. So if you're a student, you might be interested in checking out that site. Open Scholars teach open courses. We heard George yesterday, and Dave Cormier, and Alex Curios. You know, probably the folks from Utah would be up there as well. But in terms of being known for open courses, Canadians should be really proud of the fact that the world's leaders in this are all from Canada, and maybe Utah as well. Open scholars by necessity are change agents. They're willing to stick their necks out to go where other people are a little bit timid, because you know it's a mission and a vision that we're trying to really make education available to everybody, and not just the rich or the privileged. So back to Gideon Burton, his blog he posted. He said, "Open access is more than the new model for scholarly publishing. It's the only ethical move available to scholars who take their own work seriously enough to believe its value lies in how well it engages many publics and not just a few academics and not just a few peers." So I guess that ends my slide. The original presentation, slightly longer format, is available at the URL there. And I guess that brings us to the end of the formal part of Open Access Week. So. I'm going to get back and skim the text. I see Joanne has got a few comments, but we have about 3 or 4 minutes, and if anybody has a comment or a question or an opinion or an open comment, I'd be most interested in them texting it in or grabbing the mic. Well, I'll try to answer that, and maybe Cindy or Colin wants to jump in. I think the first step is a personal step, and that means that, if you're, I guess it depends what your personal circumstances are. If you are an active academic, I know I was just berating the people last night on IT Forum, one of the mailing list forums I subscribe to, and I suggested that it's time for them to follow in the footsteps of our prohibitionist forefathers and foremothers to take the pledge that they will never publish in a closed access journal or review an article for a closed access journal ever again. But I think that maybe is a bit too scary. But I think to investigate your own institution's policies, to try to begin the step of saying, why are our course materials not open access? Why don't we do some pilots to see whether it really is a theft of our property or whether it enhances our property? Why don't we have a repository for the contributions of our institution? And then personally, why don't you, write a blog and put your content up there, even if there is no repository or institutional support? All of these resources, you can become your own repository if you tag it properly. The search engines will find it, but you can also, of course, put content in Merlot or any of the other repositories. Cindy, did you have a comment on first place to start?
I agree, Terry. I do think that the first place to start is a personal place. In terms of course development and the work that we do here, the job of our learning designers is to work with faculty members and therefore to provide for them the opportunities to think about their courses in different ways. And so we have to start with that, and that means our learning designers have to be the first place. And then the faculty, when we do have a success, like our physics course, we need to showcase that. We need to share our experiences and show that not only is it possible, but that it's quality, and that it's actually fun, and it's challenging, and we need to recognize the people who are sticking their necks out as well.
Thanks, Cindy. I guess we have time for, I'm supposed to, before you run away, is to, Colin reminded me that we should have our draw for the Athabasca University T-shirt and mug, and so Colin, do you want to maybe announce those while I read these text messages?
Yeah, thanks, Terry. Our winners today we had Joanne and Rebecca, and one more just came up was Cheryl McLean. So if you could just send me an email or put your email address in the text box if you're willing to share. I've just put it in in the text box there for everybody to see. So if you can just send me an email, and I'll get in contact with you and arrange sending you your prize. Thank you.
Thanks, Colin. Alicia has a very interesting question. You know, how can you benefit financially? I think it's the prestige and the getting, you know, competing in a world market for students. I think getting your name out. And like even Athabasca, I mean, we don't have a huge amount of our content yet on open access. But I think through the promotion of the things we do, the celebration of the things we have done, I think that we've become more well-known, and not just as an open place, but as a good place to come and learn and a good place to be employed. The institutions, it's been very interesting. As editor of Arodal, we went through a major fight with SHRC, SSHRC, in regard to funding for scholarly publications. And at first, they would not allow open access. And after 2 years of battling, they changed their policy so that we're on an equal footing. In fact, we actually come out ahead because our impact factor of an open access journal is generally higher. So, and I think Joanne had a question too, but we are 1 minute over. How long will it take? Well, it always takes longer than you want, and it usually happens quicker than you think it will. So I'll give a number of answers to that. So thank you all for joining us in Open Access Week, especially Colin and Cheryl this morning. But I'd really encourage, Cindy this morning. I'd encourage you all to help us celebrate Open Access Week next week. Maybe you can get your institution to offer a t-shirt or a prize, or maybe you've got a suggestion for a speaker for Open Access Week next year. But I hope that you'll tell others, blog about the recordings, the ones that you liked, and make sure that they hit and influence the right people at your institutions. So with that, I'll bid you all a good day and a good weekend, and we'll look forward to talking to you on Cider Sessions or at Open Access Week 2011.